From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, crop formations. What's going on? Here's what's happening. A UCLA student reportedly upset about his grades fatally shot a mechanical engineering professor in a campus building Wednesday morning before turning the gun on himself. The shooting, before 10 a.m. Pacific time, brought a massive police response. Hundreds of heavily armed officers just swarmed the sprawling Westwood campus, while thousands of students and staff barricaded themselves in classrooms and offices, some using belts and chairs to secure doors. Approximately 2 hours after the shooting was first reported, the LAPD chief, Charlie Beck, declared the threat over. The chief confirmed at least 3 shots were fired and said authorities found a gun that might have been with a suicide note. Sad story there. At least 2 people died, 57 more hospitalized after attending a music festival in Florida over the weekend. Tampa police say a 22-year-old man and a 21-year-old woman were hospitalized and then they died. The investigation underway to fully determine the cause of the deaths and the reason why nearly 60 other concertgoers were hospitalized. French investigators have confirmed that one of the ships have picked up the signals under the Mediterranean Sea from one of the black boxes of the Egypt airplane that crashed last month, killing all 66 passengers and crew on board. The development raised hopes that the plane's flight data and cockpit recorders, known as the black boxes, could be retrieved and hopefully shed some light on the aircraft's tragic crash. A key report about the U.S. economy offered a subdued take, leaving open the question of whether the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates this summer. The Federal Reserve's beige book, as they call it, indicated that most areas were seeing the same modest or moderate growth through the end of May that has been the hallmark of the unspectacular expansion. Let's check in with investment advisor Catherine Austin Fitz. Catherine, what do you think? Interest rates going to go up soon?
My expectation is the Fed is going to bump them by a very nominal amount, maybe 25 basis points, which is a quarter of 1%. They had said they were going to bounce, you know, take them up a little bit every quarter, and they backed off after they did it late last year, George. So I think the pressure is really on to raise them just a small amount, and Yellen has indicated she probably will.
Wouldn't that hurt the economy, Catherine? It really hasn't rebounded yet.
It really is not enough, and one of the things that's hurting the economy tremendously is pension funds, insurance companies, savers of all kinds are not getting any return on their savings.
No, they really aren't.
There's part of the economy that really could use this as well. And, you know, it's turning out to be a giant subsidy of government and government debt. So I think there are two sides to that story, but I don't expect it to hurt the economy whatsoever.
I had a guy come up to me at a restaurant yesterday, and he said he's earning $6 a month on interest on his money in the bank. $6 a month!
Well, imagine
that'll buy stamps.
In today, if you had $100,000 in a bank CD, you were making almost nothing. You know what you were making in 1990? You were making $8,000 a year.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right.
Okay, Catherine, thanks. Be well. Catherine Austin Fitz, her website, Solari.com. From pizzas and soups to deli meats, dips, hamburgers, Americans' diets are often packed with salt, too much salt. Well, the Food and Drug Administration is moving now to cut the average salt consumption by a third in an effort to reduce heart attacks and strokes. The agency issued draft guidelines for major food manufacturers and big chain restaurants designed to reduce salt in hundreds of products with separate sodium reduction targets set for 2 and 10 years. Let's hope they pull that off. Hillary Clinton is hammering Donald Trump's namesake set of training programs, calling the Trump University School more evidence that Donald himself is a fraud. This has been the big story in all the cable news shows today, the Trump University and what's going on there. In some cases, they charged people $36,000 to attend. Well, some of the people did pay. John Hoag, of course, is an expert on prophecy, and he has predicted that Donald Trump would be president. Let's check in with John. Once we got through the Jeb Bush fiasco, John, you were right on.
Yes, and you know, what I said is that Donald Trump has the best chance of beating Hillary Clinton, who's actually the predicted president in my case.
Now, between the two of them, this may be one of the ugliest campaigns, John, I've ever seen. How about you?
Well, I mean, today it's Trump under the shadow scandal, but tomorrow it could be Hillary with her emails.
Exactly right.
And what is also going to happen in this case is that neither scandal is going to come to justice, I predict, until after the elections.
Is it conceivable that the things that you and I talked about months ago, about the resurgence of a Jeb Bush, for example, and those possibilities, could that happen?
Well, there's always a chance, but it's just like the guy in Dumb and Dumber who said a million to one chance, and he kind of grinned, hopefully, so there's still a chance. And that's kind of where that is. They're out of the picture now. Donald Trump is going to be the Republican nominee, as I predicted, and Hillary Clinton is going to run against her. Now, the situation with Clinton, though, if she wants to... I mean, we got two very unpopular candidates.
That's
as
right.
far as it goes
Generally.
With the independents, which are really going to swing who wins or loses. These scandals, these name-calling attacks that are already calling each other frauds and crooked at this early stage, before we even have the convention, is going to create a situation. The opportunity for Hillary Clinton, though, I've been saying already, writing at HogueProphecy.com about a possible future at least 3 weeks ago, of Bernie Sanders becoming her vice president nominee.
They're starting to talk about that, too.
Yeah, I noticed the mainstream's picked up on it. And the thing is, that would be a very interesting situation. That would be, it might be the first time that Hillary Clinton could get out of the box that her handlers have put her in to tell her how to think and actually do something that, because, you know, I've said that Hillary Clinton is going to be the president. But if she's not, it's because it's hers to lose. It's hers to screw up. It's really going to be a test now to see whether she really has talent at this. And if she were to make the bold move and pay the high political price of making Bernie Sanders her vice president, then she will, I predict, I might as well sit back and say I've just won number 13.
Well, that's right. That's right.
Because it'll be a question of how big the landslide is. But she will have to pay a really high price. But this would be a great opportunity for her to see if she can balance the corporate side of the Democratic Party with the progressive side. And if she can be the balance, the mom in the party of rebellious children, then... that would be a sign that she might be a good president. Might, I stress. So, and then that would also be a slam dunk. She would win, but she would constantly have Bernie Sanders and his millions of people, who, unlike Barack Obama, those people are not going to be cast off and forgotten. There are going to be a million watchdogs.
That's right.
Every step that she makes in the next 4 years.
John, we got to get you back for a full show, okay?
I think I'm coming on next week.
Oh, I love it. Okay.
From today.
That's quick. Thank you, John. John Hogue, he's an expert in prophecy, expert in Nostradamus. There was still no swimming allowed at the Southern California beach where a shark attacked a 52-year-old. The woman was training for the triathlon, swimming about 500 feet offshore when the shark struck her. Lots of shark attacks lately. What's going on? But in a moment, Steve Alton joins us as we talk about his Meg series. Matter of fact, the movie is going to finally be made. Lots to talk about with Steve in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. George Norrie here. Steve Alton, our guest for the next couple hours. New York Times best-selling author, a number of novels, including the Meg series. And the Meg series, of course, has just been pushed for a major motion picture by Warner Brothers, and it's going to be exciting film. Steve, when does that come out?
Hey, George, it comes out March of 2018.
That's going to come up sooner than later. That's going to be exciting.
Well, it's been a long wait, but we're finally approaching it.
How many of the Meg series books? At least three, right?
Yeah, there's four out, and the fifth one comes out in 2 weeks, called Meg Night Stalkers.
And that's the one that's going to be tied into the book?
No, the original Meg, which I just redid entirely and added a prequel and 17 commission images for the inside, that's out in paperback now, and was just released back in December, an all-new release, and so that's the one that's going to focus on the original.
Super. Now, when we talk about Meg, what are we talking about?
Well, Meg, or Megalodon, or Carcharodon Megalodon, which means big tooth, was the apex predator of all time. You're talking about a 60 to 70-foot prehistoric great white shark that probably weighed close to 150,000 to 200,000 pounds.
Jeez.
And, you know, our modern-day great whites weigh, a big one might weigh about 2,000 pounds, so this was, you know, quite a bit bigger. And we have fossilized Megalodon teeth that are 6 to 7 inches long, so we can extrapolate from that how big these things were, and the edges are all serrated, and this creature's jaws were so large it could have swallowed a baby elephant in one bite.
When you visited our studios years ago and you brought that replica of a large, what was that, an eel or a shark? What was
that was from Loch Ness. That was the publisher for the Loch had put up a contest because all the research that I had done and speaking to Bill McDonald and a few other cryptozoologists pointed to the fact that Nessie was a type of eel, an anguilla eel.
Mm-hmm.
And so the publisher put out a reward, $10,000, to any fisherman who could catch an anguilla eel so that we could extrapolate how its teeth were and how big it was. And fishermen caught one and sent us the teeth, and we were able to extrapolate based upon some of the evidence out there, and so that was a mold of the how big this eel would be, which was about 40 feet long. So
I remember people seeing that. You had it outside.
Yeah, we had a museum curator using a smaller skull, extrapolate it out, and build the actual, what Nessie's skull would look like. It's pretty frightening looking.
We'll get some Nessie updates later on in the show from you. But
sure.
This Megalodon that was around then, this huge shark-like animal, this creature, might it still be around today?
Well, that's the big question. And you have to realize that these weren't dinosaurs. They didn't die off because of the asteroid strike or other changes in seas. You know, they were around about 30 million years ago to as recently as 10,000 years ago. So they were actually around when modern man was still alive or Homo sapiens were alive. So they didn't die off because of the things that killed the dinosaurs. But as far as, are they still alive? Well, they could be, because you have to realize that 70% of the Earth is covered by oceans, and only 5% have been explored, and only 1% of the deep water. So if these creatures went deep, they may be out there, and we wouldn't even know it till we crossed one.
What did a creature that large, Steve, what did it eat?
Their main part of their diet was whales.
Oh, my gosh.
And they could take down a whale and pretty quickly. So we actually have Megalodon teeth that are embedded in whale bone.
If one of these creatures opened its mouth all the way, how big would that be? Would a human be able to stand from tooth to tooth?
Oh, yeah. In fact, one of the Megalodon fossilized tooth hunters, the late Vito Bertucci, had built a jaw that was 10 feet high. And I've got pictures of me standing in it, and you can easily fit 6 or 7 people in there. And this thing is huge.
And no wonder they go after whales.
Yeah, yeah.
Where would they hide if they were around?
Well, see, that's the thing. There's a lot of reasons why they may have disappeared. And supposedly, experts say that changes in the water temperature because of the last ice age may have killed them off, and Megs may have starved because the whales' migration patterns had changed. Others say that the megalodons couldn't handle a drop in ocean temperatures. I'm not buying either theory. First of all, because big sharks like great whites and megalodon are actually warm-bodied, which they have a process called gigantothermy, which is basically a series of blood vessels which are used by the muscles to warm blood into the extremity. So the cold doesn't bother a big shark like that. What I think would happen is that orcas came around. And orcas hunt in pods, and megs are lone hunters, and the orca could take down a megalodon. And I don't think they did it much to the adults, but what they probably hunted, because orcas hunt in shallows, they took down the nurseries, the megalodon nurseries, so they gradually forced the creatures into extinction. However, if the megalodons went deep, which would make sense because whales are air breathers and they can't go deep, they could still be out there.
The deepest part of the oceans is the Mariana Trench, which is south of Japan. That's in the Pacific Ocean, the western part.
Right.
How deep does that go?
Well, the Mariana Trench is about 36,000 feet at its deepest part, which is about 7 miles down, and that's the deepest part of the world, like you mentioned. It's also pretty big, too. It's 1,550 miles long and 40 miles wide, and it's basically unexplored, and in the novel Meg, that's where the creatures are, in the Mariana Trench.
Smart place to put them.
Yeah. Well, there's reasons for it, too, because there are hydrothermal vents down there, and hydrothermal vents, besides superheating the water along the bottom, 700-degree Fahrenheit water pumps out of these vents, it also pumps out minerals that create something called chemosynthesis, which is like photosynthesis only with chemicals. And so you have tube worms and all sorts of exotic life growing down there based upon feeding off of the chemicals. And you've got an entire food chain down at the bottom of the ocean.
How could ocean pressure not harm creatures that go down that deep? I mean, if we took a submarine down 6 or 7 miles, the thing would be crushed.
You're right.
What? Why not these sea creatures?
Well, the reason that the submarine would be crushed is the same reason that a diver would be crushed. That's because humans and subs have air cavities, so the air is falls under the pressure and is crushed. But fish, there's no air cavities in them, so the pressure doesn't affect the fish.
They're equalized, I guess.
Exactly. So the ocean literally moves through the fish.
Okay. I want to talk about the movie, which is tied into your novels and your books. How did you come up with the idea for Meg?
That's an interesting question. I haven't been asked that for a while. You know, I'd always growing up, I loved reading Jaws, and that led me to reading real-life shark attacks by great whites. And there was always a blurb about Carcharodon megalodon accompanied by a Smithsonian photo of six nerdy-looking scientists sitting in the jaw. But there was never anything commercial written about it. And back in, 1995, I was reading a Time magazine, and on the front page was the Mariana Trench. And the article discussed hydrothermal vents and chemosynthesis and life at the bottom of the ocean. And, you know, I started thinking, what was that giant shark with the nerdy-looking scientist sitting in it? And I went to the library, because there was no internet back then in 95, and found the picture and found about the shark and sort of married the idea and set a goal that I was going to write this book. And because I had a job, a J-O-B, which I was just over broke, you know, I had to work on the book at night from about 10 o'clock at night till 3 in the morning, and which is where I became a Coast to Coast fan. And, so I'd work on the book at night and on weekends, and on September Friday the 13th, went to my J-O-B as a general manager at a meat company and lost my job. And 2 days later, Meg went out to the 6 biggest publishing houses in New York, and buoyed by the fact that we had a first look deal with Disney's Hollywood Pictures back then, Meg was sold to Bantam Doubleday.
Exciting. You must have been excited too.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, there's no bigger thrill than knowing that your book's going to get published and your hard work is there. And we'll talk about the Night Stalkers, because my publisher is publishing that book too, which is fantastic. Steve Alton, our guest here on Coast to Coast. Next hour, we'll talk about Nessie and Cece, some sea creatures, which you'll be calling us on. Welcome back with Steve Alton and his Meg series, the books. And, of course, it's going to become a movie, and you'll be able to see it sometime in 2018. Steve, when you finally wrote the first book and you talked about the Mariana Trench, you were attacked by the L.A. Times, weren't you?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. What happened was is when I first got the book deal, the L.A. Times asked for an interview, and so they sent a reporter out to my house, and he did a great job, and he came out with a great quote, which was Jurassic Shark.
I love that.
Yeah, it's terrific. And Bantam Doubleday used it on the cover of their hardback. Well, Steve Wasserman, who was the L.A. Times book reviewer, he didn't like it that it was taken. And so he hired Richard Ellis, who actually writes marine books and is a painter, to sort of...
He's got more like a science background too, doesn't he?
Yeah. And he was hired basically to do a hatchet job, which he did. He took an advanced reading copy and criticized everything from the name of the book to the science in it, claiming that there were no hydrothermal vents in the Mariana Trench. There's no sea life in the Mariana Trench, and only in Alton's topsy-turvy world could hot water be below cold water, and it was ridiculous, and you know, so I wrote back, and we sort of went back and forth each other in the LA Times, which Steve Wasserman was encouraging, and 2 weeks ago, the NOAA did some explorations of the Mariana Trench. They sent a drone down there, and lo and behold, guess what they found? Hydrothermal vents.
Just what you said.
Just what I said, and fish, and sharks, and all sorts of marine life down there. So
and new marine life. Marine life we didn't know anything about.
Exactly. In fact, they found an albino fish that they called a ghost shark. And I called it 20 years ago, and of course it's a fictional book, but still I endeavor to get the science right. And
well, that's why I think a megalodon could be down there somewhere, or somewhere.
That I think you're right. The oceans are so vast, so unexplored, and we're finding new creatures all the time, including really big sharks. So you never know what's down there, and a shark doesn't have to surface to show its telltale dorsal fin. It can stay down there indefinitely. There's no reason for it to surface, and there's plenty of fish down there.
So when all the books were being written, you've been wanting to do the movie for years. How did it finally happen?
Well, the third time they say is the shot. So the first time was with Hollywood Pictures, and what happened was they went through some subpar screenplays, and the head of Hollywood Pictures was fired. And when you have a CEO of a studio leave, all the projects that he signed,
they go with him.
Yeah, because, you know, the new guy doesn't want to give credit to the old guy.
That's right.
So then about 5 years went by, and a friend of mine, Nick Nunziata, who ran Chud.com, found out the book was available, took it to his friend Guillermo del Toro, who took it to producer Lloyd Levin. And the next thing we know is that it was being set up at New Line Cinema, and they went through some problems, too. And so the rights were reverted. And then I sold the rights to a friend of mine, producer Belle Avery. And Belle Avery was a bulldog. I mean, she just stayed with it for 7 years, got it independently financed out of China with Gravity Pictures. And so they put up all the money, and then we took it out for distribution. And Warner Brothers loved the idea and wanted to be involved in it as partners. We've got John Turteltaub as the director. He did National Treasure. And Jason Statham is the action hero, which
I like him. He's the Brit. He's the Brit. He's very good.
Yeah, so you know, I'm really excited about that, and they They signed the biggest actress in China, Fan Bingbing, and she's all signed up now too. So they start filming August 29th, and you know, it's exciting.
Well, good for you. That is exciting. And do you have any editorial control or not?
Mine was the first script along with Bell Avery, and I co-wrote a script, and that was the one that garnered the money. And then it's gone through several different screenwriters, and so at this point, no. To answer your question, I have no control over it.
All right, so let's talk about some of the other works. Night Stalkers, of course, the one you're working on, the re-release on that too. My publisher is publishing this one, is it not?
Yeah, we're both with Forge, Tor Forge, and I'm excited about your book too. I know it's coming out the end of July, and I've already ordered a copy.
Oh, great!
I can't wait to read it.
I got to sign it for you.
I would love that.
Yeah, that's about conspiracies and a talk show host. Go figure, right? Go figure. But the last time we were on, we were talking about Lake Vostok. Remember that?
Yes, absolutely.
Tell me a little bit what's been going on there.
Well, you know, in the book Vostok, you know, they discover marine life down there and some other things in this subglacial lake that's 2.5 miles beneath the ice in Antarctica. And since then, they've done some exploration of other lakes, including one of the subglacial lakes that's in Night Stalkers, and they found life down there, fish and other marine creatures. So it's amazing where sea life can proliferate.
Well, indeed it is. I mean, it's just an incredible, incredible planet. Now they're talking about there's water underneath the surface of the moon caused from asteroids. They talked last week about tsunamis on Mars during its heyday. It's amazing what's out there in the universe, Steve.
Yeah, absolutely. And in Vostok deals with Mars's past also. And they have calderas, huge calderas, the remains of calderas on Mars. And they believe that's what, you know, there used to be life on Mars and there used to be oceans on Mars. And what happened was the calderas detonated, you know, exploded, and that took the atmosphere with it.
Now, you're also working on a novel, are you not, called Unacknowledged, with Dr. Stephen Greer, who comes on the program.
Yeah, he was on last Friday night.
Yeah, he was on Friday. That's right.
It's an interesting situation because I was writing the third part in the Domain series called Phobos back in 2011, and there's a part of the book storyline that deals with extraterrestrials. So I had, in doing the research, I came across Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project, and I was just blown away by it. And so I contacted him and asked permission if I could use some of the testimonials in between chapters, you know, to sort of set the tone. And he was kind enough to give me permission, and when the book was done, I sent one to him and his wife, and she read the book, and the next thing I know is I got an email in August of 2013 that said, we're coming down to Miami in December. Would you like, you and your wife like to get to dinner? And I thought, yeah, that's terrific. Well, 2 days, this is just an amazing story, 2 days before we were supposed to meet the Greers, my wife and I are in West Palm Beach. We're driving home on a Saturday night from a movie, and I'm going through my neighborhood. It's about 11 o'clock at night, and I look up in the sky, and there's something in the sky flying over us. And we got out of the car, and there were UFOs flying over us, very low in the sky, totally silent, totally smooth.
I think they follow him.
Well, I'm sorry?
They follow him.
They do. That's absolutely right. They do. They're sort of, you know, we were blown away, first of all, and the sky was as clear as can be, and we stood there watching them as they went from south to north and flew over us and disappeared into the ether, just not in a cloud, just disappeared. And 2 days later, of course, we had dinner with the Greers, and that's the first thing that we said, you know, you can't believe what happened. He says, that happens a lot. For people who are meeting him for the first time, it's because the way extraterrestrials communicate is through
It's telepathic.
Yes, through consciousness.
Yeah.
Telepathy, and they sort of check out the people that he's going to be associated with, and you know, hopefully I passed the test, and we met several times and decided we were going to work on a book together. And Unacknowledged is the book. I'm actually doing Unacknowledged the novel. He's doing Unacknowledged the Secret Files.
Yeah.
Which deals with the things that are in the story that I'm writing. And then, of course, he's got a documentary coming out called Unacknowledged and a concert. And, you know, this is Stephen's big push to try to get the world to understand that we need to release these black shell projects, these energy technologies dealing with zero-point energy. And, you know, our future's at stake because, you know, the planet is suffering under climate change, and unless we get off of fossil fuels, we're just going to go over the cliff.
Well, you know, Stephen, until these people figure out how to make money on this, I don't think they want us to know about it or to use it.
Oh, they definitely don't want us to use it because, you know, because zero-point energy would change everything. It would allow third world countries to compete with the United States and Britain. It would allow African nations to, you know, expand and build things and use have free energy as the rest of the world would. And of course, the big change would be that we wouldn't need fossil fuels anymore. And that's only $100 trillion aggregate industry. And
that's right.
And so the haves don't want to share with the have-nots, and that's the big problem.
So tell me what your thoughts are going to be when you are invited to the screening of the film on Meg for the very first time. What's it going to be like for you?
You know,
you will be there, right?
I hope, God willing, and I'm sure I'll be extremely excited. And you know, it's been a long time. It's been 20 years, but. You know, we'll just wait a little bit longer.
Are they going to follow the word of the novel, or are they going to come up with their own twist? What do you think?
Well, you know, as a fellow author, you know that that's always the dream, that you write the book and they follow the
story. They follow the story, yeah.
But it never turns out that way, you know, and sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not. But, you know, I think that they'll follow it, stay true to it, pretty much through it. I know they changed the Japanese characters to Chinese characters because the Chinese companies are putting up the money, so I had no problem with that. And you know, the Meg doesn't care what it eats.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all digestible.
I mean, that's amazing, though, that it eats whales. Have any whale carcasses shown up on beaches like they were bitten or anything like that? I know there have been some strange creatures that have popped up on the beaches dead.
There have been, and tough to identify them. But the thing with a whale is that, and all sea creatures, is that the carcass sinks, and then it's attacked by other predators, and you know, all you have left is the cartilage or the bones. And with sharks, dead sharks don't float. They, you know, they sink also, and they don't wash ashore, so... there's no way to really tell.
Yeah, and they're really way out there in the ocean, too.
Exactly. And, you know, that's what people don't realize. They figure, well, if we haven't seen a fin, then they must not be out there. But, I mean, you know, if you take a boat out a couple miles offshore, you're going a pretty far away, but you're not going anywhere out into the real ocean.
True. Well, you know, it's like this planet, Stephen. You know, people say, why can't we find a Bigfoot? This is a big, big planet.
Yeah.
And it's easy for creatures to hide, especially if they know where they are. You know, they know the woods, they know the forests. I mean, it's just difficult to find these things, isn't it?
Even in a 26-mile-long lake like Loch Ness, it's you know, it doesn't seem like it would be that hard, but, you know, there's nooks and crannies down there and caverns and places to hide and you know, sound echoes off of the walls of the trough, which is what Loch Ness is. So it's difficult to find.
I want to talk more about Loch Ness when we come back after the top of the hour. But are you still convinced that Nessie is this giant eel?
I am, absolutely. It just makes the most sense, and there's eels in Loch Ness, and they migrate from the Sargasso Sea, and
are they prehistoric?
No, they're not prehistoric, but they're capable of going on land, and the thing about the females is that what triggers their death, what triggers their lifespan to end, is when they give birth to their young. Well, if a big one was stuck in Loch Ness and couldn't get out through an aquifer, it would just keep getting bigger.
Like a huge catfish, that
like
kind of
thing.
Huge
catfish, exactly.
They do. They just get bigger and bigger and bigger. So in terms of the size, how long would they be if you stretched it out?
Could be as long as 40 feet, and that's a big fish.
And how thick are they?
Probably is
like a foot?
I would say as thick as a garage, not a garage, but a refrigerator, on its side.
Really?
And,
that's huge.
And they have teeth that run down the roof of their mouth, which are barbed, which prevents their prey from exiting their mouth. So they're pretty nasty creatures. They've got slime all over them.
Couple eyes, obviously, right?
Yeah, and bulbous eyes, and they can basically live down on the bottom of the of Loch Ness, or they can come ashore.
Do they have flippers?
They have fins. Yeah, they have fins.
Do they use those fins to walk on shore?
Yes.
How far inland can they go? Before they
probably don't want to leave the water too far, but back when the law came out, there were these tracks that supposedly were found by somebody along the shoreline, and they were pretty wide tracks, so they weren't far offshore though.
If you were to see it in the water in the lock, what would it look like? Because remember that picture, and it looked like a plesiosaur's head sticking out.
It wouldn't look like that. It would probably look more like a wake.
Okay, with a couple humps?
It's depending upon how it was swimming. I mean, they don't have humps, but...
But do they swim like that?
Yeah, they swim sort of like a snake.
Okay. And the flippers are flipping, and that's what they use to maneuver?
Yeah, they're forward flippers, so they, you know...
Do they make noise?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, they do make noise. They sort of make a sort of a high-pitched screeching sound.
God, has anybody ever recorded them? I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, I'll have to I'll
get
have
me
to
one of those. Yeah, if you can find that,
that would be
fantastic. So the books are all available all over the place, right?
Correct.
And the movie, of course, will come out in 2008. That'll be the big screen, and I'm sure it'll hit the old DVD group and Amazon and Netflix. They'll pick it up. And you may never have to write another book again, Stephen.
Well.
But you like doing this.
Yeah, I do. I do. But, it's a lot easier to write when you're not worried about paying the rent.
That's true. Absolutely. And how's the family? How's everything going?
Very good. Thank you.
Good. Stephen, we're going to take some phone calls with you next hour. Give us your website, if you would.
It's www.stevealten.com. And there's book trailers on there and giant make posters, and you can read free chapters of any of the books. The new Meg is on sale at Amazon right now for a pretty good price.
So. Super. What drives you? I mean, you love doing what you do.
I do. I really do. And I love my fans. I have I let them into my personal life, my web. My email, I've had the same email address for the last 17 years, and I make my fans characters in the books, it used to be that anybody who gave Meg a bad review got eaten, but then I made it open to the readers, and they seem to like to get eaten, so it's become a status.
All right, Stephen, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM, and we'll take phone calls next hour as we talk about the Loch Ness Monster and Megalodons, these huge shark-like creatures in the sea, And whatever else you want to talk with Stephen about on Coast to Coast AM.